Judges of the United States Court of Appeals and Court of Seventh Judicial Circuit. Hear ye, hear ye, hear ye. All persons having business before this honorable court are admonished to draw near and give their attention. The court is now sitting. God save the United States and this honorable court.
Morning, ladies and gentlemen. We have an applicant for admission. Mr. Vincent, you want to bring your applicant forward?
Thank you, Judge Posner. I'm here this morning to move the admission of Mr. Timothy Leek. Just by way of brief explanation as to how Mr. Leek arrived here today. In September, I accepted an appointment of a block of six cases from this court as part of a pro bono initiative at my office, and Mr. Leek is one of the associates in my office who volunteered to participate in this project. Mr. Leek is a graduate of Luther College in Iowa, where he graduated with honors. He was a NCAA Division III All-American, academic All-American tennis player. He went to the John Marshall Law School, where he graduated in the top 15% of his class and was a member of the Law Review. He's been working at my firm for the past 3 years. He started there as a law clerk working for me personally. I can vouch for his honesty and integrity based on his work for me and his work with my partners and my clients. And I can also vouch for his honesty and integrity because in all the times I've played tennis with Mr. Leek, he's never made a bad line call and never let me win a game either. So with that, I would ask that you... Oh, he also externed for Judge Lindberg here. Mm-hmm. For a semester, and also did an externship with the Securities and Exchange Commission. This is his first court appearance. He's actually a transactions lawyer, not one of our litigators, but he wanted to be involved in this process.
Well, thank you very much, Mr. Vincent, and such an enthusiastic endorsement. We're very happy to have you as a member of our court, Mr. Leek, so if you'll step over the clerk will administer the oath. Okay, so we can begin our first case for argument, United States versus Brown. Ms. Lewis.
May it please the court, counsel. My name is Evelyn Lewis. I represent appellant Timothy Brown. The first issue I'd like to discuss is the district court's denial of Mr. Brown's motion to suppress evidence, which was seized from Mr. Brown's residence at 3040 Lincoln Street in East St. Louis on July 20th, 2001. The court's finding that third party Stephon Laurie, whose name was on the apartment lease, had apparent authority to consent to the search, we believe was erroneous. The law is clear that a third party can consent to a search if that third party possesses either actual or apparent authority, actual authority being having some mutual use of the property or joint access or control over the property. Apparent authority exists where law enforcement officers reasonably believe that the third party has the authority over the property. And the test, which is applied, is whether a reasonable person with the same knowledge that the officer has would reasonably believe that third party, here, Mr. Laurie, had authority to consent. But
before you go on, isn't the real problem you have that ultimately they obtained a search warrant, so it would have been inevitably discovered anyway?
Judge, I don't believe the inevitable discovery doctrine is applicable here. The law is clear that simply because probable cause exists to justify the issuance of a warrant, and probable cause always has to exist to have a warrant issued, that's not enough standing alone to warrant the application of the inevitable discovery doctrine. Otherwise, the pre-approval requirement of getting a warrant becomes nullified. And I believe this court in another case, U.S. versus Brown, 1995 case, actually pointed out that probable cause alone is not enough. There must be probable cause and a chain of events that would have led to a warrant independent of the search. And in this particular case, a warrant was not even sought until after the drugs and money had been discovered in Mr. Brown's apartment pursuant to the officer getting Mr. Laurie to consign the consent. So in that regard, I think the inevitable discovery doctrine is clearly inapplicable here. The motivating factor for getting the warrant did not even occur until they discovered the drugs.
But the basis for the warrant, as I understand it, what was in the affidavit was information, not information that they obtained after they searched, but information that they had prior to the search.
Judge, that is correct. However, the information that was not in the warrant, they left out the fact that they had already searched and had gotten this consent from Mr. Laurie. They left out certain facts that had the magistrate been aware of. He may have said, I'm going to allow this search warrant to apply for any subsequent items you seize, but clearly the first search was tainted. And in looking at, you know, the information in the application, yes, certainly the warrant application shows probable cause. But again, I think the case law is clear. Just because that warrant application shows probable cause, that doesn't mean we then apply the inevitable discovery doctrine where an officer has just chosen not to get a search warrant. Because if that were the case, anytime an officer chooses not to get a search warrant, if there's probable cause that exists, they could later go get a warrant and say, well, we had probable cause anyway, and so therefore the inevitable discovery doctrine should shield this improper search from the exclusionary rule. And I don't believe that is what this circuit held in the previous case of U.S. v. Brown and the other cases as well. And I think the government has conceded in its brief that Mr. Laurie's consent was in fact questionable. He did not live at the apartment. He had rented the apartment for Mr. Brown. These factors were told immediately to the officer. And having those factors, he should have known at that point he was put on notice that there was no apparent authority for him to consent to the search.
Well, ultimately that dawned on the officer, and that's why he called, wasn't it, a prosecutor to find out how he should proceed, and he was told to seek the warrant.
Well, I think he was not told to proceed to get a warrant until after he advised that he had already made the discovery. The chain of events took place by first, the officer got the consent to search signed, knowing that Mr. Laurie didn't live at the apartment, knowing that Mr. Laurie had rented the apartment merely as a favor because Mr. Brown had poor credit. He then advises the U.S. Attorney's Office of the consent to search. At that point, the U.S. Attorney's Office does not advise, stop searching, go get a search warrant. Right. They knew at that point, or should have known, that Mr. Laurie's consent to search was at best questionable, but they say continue the search. He continues, then discovers the items in question, which is the large amount of drugs and the money. At that point, he notifies the U.S. Attorney's Office of his discovery, and then they say, stop the search, get a search warrant. So therefore, the triggering factor was the discovery of the drugs and money. It was not the fact that the first call had come to the U.S. Attorney's Office saying that, you know, we have some issues with Mr. Laurie's consent. Because clearly, what happened after that was not, go get a search warrant. So therefore, it's not inevitable that they would have sought a search warrant, because if they would have, why didn't they do it upon immediately notifying the U.S. Attorney's Office of the problems with Mr. Laurie's consent? And with respect to the other issues in the brief, I'd like to address those in my rebuttal period.
Okay, thank you, Ms. Lewis. Mm-hmm. Mr. Friedrich?
Thank you, Your Honors. May it please the court, counsel. The purpose of the exclusionary rule is to punish police for misconduct. And in this case, there just simply was no police misconduct. On July 17th of 2001, Deputy U.S. Marshals, along with various state people, went to attempt to arrest Mr. Brown at a residence in East St. Louis on Brinson Street. They had information he was staying there. They checked with a neighbor who indicated, yes, this person lived there, but they had learned that this place was rented by a person by the name of Stefan Lowry. Mr. Brown was not at that residence when they went in there that morning. 2 days later, they get information that he, in fact, had moved to this address on Lincoln Street. They verify that by seeing his car out there and by talking to two other renters the day before. On the morning of July 20th, they go in and, armed with the state arrest warrant for Mr. Lowry, knock on the door, and the perimeter agents protecting the perimeter see drugs being thrown out of one of the windows. And they also see an individual flash by another window with what clearly is a gun. So they go in and they see Mr. Brown coming from the room where the drugs have been thrown out of the window. They arrest him. There are two other individuals in the room, a juvenile and a young lady. And they do a protective sweep and they find more drugs on the windowsill there. And under a pile of clothing in the bedroom, they find a gun. At that point, they call the United States Attorney's Office about, obviously they have suspicions that there may be more in that apartment. They're told to try to get a search warrant. Well, who do they go to? But they go to Stefan Lowry, the person, the renter of the place. And he's in St. Louis. Two of the marshals go over there. The remainder secure the Lincoln residence or apartment. When they get over there and they confront him with the fact they find drugs and a gun there, he says, "Look, I don't live there." But they say, "Well, will you give us consent to search?" They get consent to search from him. At that point, they call the marshals back at the address and say, "We've gotten consent to search." At that point in time, there was apparent authority for Mr. Lowry to give search. They didn't know exactly what the arrangement or anything like that was. They go ahead and start the search. They continue to question Mr. Lowry, and in the course of that questioning determine, look, he really maybe doesn't live there. Maybe he is nothing but a straw purchaser, as he tells them, how he had actually rented the Brinson address as well as the Lincoln address at Brown's request. And one reason was is Brown had been dealing drugs from a residence next door to his mother's house in East St. Louis. They called the U.S. Attorney's Office, and in the meantime, the marshals on the scene had discovered another large amount of drugs. They called the United States Attorney's Office, and they're told, well, look, we better go get a search warrant, and as Judge Williams has indicated, they apply for a search warrant, and they don't put in that search warrant the fact of things that may have been tainted after the consent. It's all stuff leading up to the consent. So actually, this search of that residence was conducted pursuant to a valid search warrant.
What about counsel's position that they should have disclosed in the affidavit all that prior history that you just?
Your Honor,
I
think the law is to the contrary, that if you have potentially questionable facts leading up to a chain which may give you probable cause, if you include them in the in the affidavit for the search warrant, you ultimately get the fruit of the poisonous tree, which was the result of the search after the search warrant. You have to exclude those potentially questionable facts. And here, a United States magistrate made an independent determination, absent those, if they were indeed questionable facts, that there was probable cause to search the place. If they'd have put them in there, the issue would be...
What do you mean by questionable facts?
So, well, they did find drugs. After they got consent, they started searching, and they found additional drugs, which ultimately formed the basis for the charges in this case. They knew that at the time the search warrant was applied for. Those facts are not included in the affidavit
for
the search warrant.
So what makes them questionable?
We say there's nothing questionable about them, but in an overabundance of caution, because they found those facts based on the search which commenced based on the consent received from Mr. Lowry. Certainly we believe at the time the consent to search by Mr. Lowry was, a reasonable person would have believed he had authority to give consent to search. As the questioning of him progressed, whether it did or didn't, ultimately the bottom line is that the inevitable discovery rule comes in and what they did was entirely appropriate. If the court has no more questions on that particular issue, I'll just briefly discuss the 404B issue. Similar evidence is an abuse of discretion standard, which the judge clearly did not abuse his discretion permitting that evidence in. And the sufficiency of the evidence issue, the last issue raised by counsel, clearly there was more than sufficient evidence for the jury to render its verdict in this case.
So as to the 404B evidence, what was the evidence that tied Brown to that apartment in the first search? What was let in?
They had testimony from Mr. Lowry that he had rented the apartment for Mr. Brown. There was evidence from the neighbors that Mr. Brown had lived there. But the landlord especially knew that Mr. Brown was living there and was in fact ready to kick him out, or was in the process of kicking him out because of the drug dealing going on there at that apartment. And that was the evidence that was introduced on that, which would tie him. And clearly the third prong of the Huddleston test, which is that a jury could reasonably find that, is met by that evidence. Lowry himself talks about Brown living there.
Okay.
Thank you, Ron.
Thank you, Mr. Frazier. Ms. Lewis, how much time does she have? 3 minutes?
Regarding the 404B evidence, the court asked what evidence linked Brown to the Brinson residence, and absolutely no evidence linked him to that search at Brinson. Mr. Brown had lived at Brinson during that summer, but had moved out by the time that residence was searched on July 17th. He was living at the 3040 Lincoln address. When law enforcement officers came into Brinson, there were four black males hiding in the house, in the attic, where drugs were found. Also, when law enforcement officers came in, there was crack cocaine, a gun, and money on the living room floor in the open. It makes no sense that Brown would have moved out of the apartment and then left drugs on the living room floor and a gun on the living room floor right in plain sight. Obviously, those drugs belonged to some individual who had been in the house. There was no testimony by this landlord that he'd ever personally observed Mr. Brown make a drug transaction when he was living at the Brinson residence. There simply was no link except for the fact that in the summer he had lived in that apartment, but the landlord testified there were four males who hung out at that apartment all the time, and the law is clear in U.S. v. Windham that a connection to property or the fact that you're on it doesn't mean you constructively possess the drugs. And on the 17th, when the drugs were seized from Brinson, Mr. Brown was not even there, didn't live there. There were four black males there. There was drugs open in the living room floor. How could a jury reasonably conclude that Brown was responsible for that activity? I think 404B clearly does not apply here. With respect to my last argument was the motion for judgment of acquittal, Mr. Brown was charged with not only possession, but possession with intent to distribute. This court has held in U.S. v. Windham that an accused, when the crime charge is intent to distribute drugs, an accused only has control of narcotics when he has the authority, not the legal authority, but the recognized authority in his criminal milieu to possess and determine the disposition of the drugs. And this court has said even though the prosecution may rely on evidence that shows a person's property interest, that's not enough. They need some evidence showing that Brown had authority with respect to the drugs. There was no evidence whatsoever presented with respect to either the Lincoln search and seizure or the Brinson search and seizure, and we ask that the convictions be set aside.
Okay, thank you, Ms. Lewis. Thank you, Mr. Preacher. Next case for argument is Carter v.